Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This is your host, Stephen Novella. Today is Wednesday, September 7th, 2005. With me tonight are Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, all.
Bob Novella.
Hello.
And Perry DeAngelis.
Hello.
Our guest for tonight is Stephen Malloy, who is the publisher of JunkScience.com. He'll be joining us in just a few minutes. But first, a couple of quick segments, some follow-up on some previous items that we discussed. You guys all remember the haunted dolls for sale on eBay.
Yes.
Well, a listener sent me a link for a haunted phone for sale on eBay.
Cool.
The link will be on our website. But it's essentially a red rotary phone, like a 1950s, 60s model telephone. Mm-hmm. And a long, long story to go along with the item. Apparently, it's very sinister looking because it's red and it has like the number on it is number 666 and it was inspected by inspector number 666.
Well, there you go.
And, you know, the usual stories. I left it on the table, and the next thing I know, it was somewhere else, or the statue of the Virgin Mary I had next to it was found broken on the floor.
Isn't this a Twilight Zone episode?
Right.
It was a haunted phone or something.
The worst was the seller claimed that at one point in time, there was a burn mark all around the phone, as if something had... Like there was a radiation of heat. The phone itself was pristine, was unharmed, but the table all around the phone had a burn mark on it.
So it's kind of like a spontaneous telephonic combustion type of thing?
Telephonic combustion. Although the phone itself didn't combust. It kind of reminded me of that scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, where the Nazi symbol on the crate just sort of burned. But if you look at the picture... The burn outline of the phone is not quite perfect. You know what I mean? It doesn't exactly follow the edge of the phone on the table.
Like are you
like it was man-made.
This evidence, Steve?
Right, like it was created around the phone rather than, you know, because if you any kind of radiation that's blocked by an object should produce a pretty perfect silhouette on the item behind it. And this was, I'll just say it was less than perfect. But it was going, the bid was going for, I think, $80 or something.
Is it still up for auction, Steve?
No, the auction had completed. So, yeah, interesting, you know, that their haunted items are branching out on eBay. This one was, you know, I thought particularly humorous. It was kind of cheesy, a red phone with the number 666 on it. A demon phone.
Wow.
Also, a bit of follow-up from, before we proceed with science or fiction, I have a follow-up from... the last science or fiction from 2 weeks ago. If you recall, the theme was the solar system, and the item which was made up was the discovery of an active volcano on Saturn's moon Titan.
So I know where you're going with this.
I did some more research just to see if there's anything else out there that I may have missed, and it turns out a few things came up. So I had claimed that the only active volcanoes in the solar system are on Earth and on Jupiter's moon Io, because Jupiter's moon Io is close enough to the planet that the tidal forces from Jupiter actually push and pull and stretch Io so that it's constantly molten and there's active volcanoes and the planet's basically turning itself inside out. Well, Saturn's smallest moon, Enceladus, also has active volcanoes on it. Or Enceladus, I think it might be Enceladus. Although these volcanoes, it also is close to Saturn and its tidal forces that it's thought to be the driving force behind the volcanoes. However, these quote-unquote volcanoes are spewing ice.
Wow.
Because Enceladus is an icy world. So not exactly, you know, lava, but spewing essentially ice, and there is a wispy sort of atmosphere around Enceladus, which is, I guess...
Well, that's bizarre. I mean, yeah. If you've got the tidal forces... You'd think it would you know, liquefy, you know, would create molten rock or ore, and it would just spew that. So how could you?
The moon is probably mostly water and ice, like Europa or Ganymede, at least towards the surface.
That just seems pretty bizarre.
There was another report of Neptune's largest moon, Triton, was found to have what one astronomer called a volcano, but the other references I said refer to them as nitrogen geysers. So not volcanic, again, not lava, not mountainous volcanoes, but geysers of nitrogen. And then finally, and this is just from a couple of months ago, and the report that I read was from July, so this is very recent. The Cassini probe has indeed found pictures of what looks like a volcano on Titan, which was the specific example that I had used in the science or fiction. However, there's no direct evidence of an eruption. That is, so there's no picture of it erupting.
So what's the bottom line here, Steve?
But there's indirect evidence that it may be spewing forth ice and ammonia. So you may have ice and ammonia volcanoes on Titan.
So this invalidates your whole science or fiction from last
year. Well,
is that what you're saying?
The bottom line is that, you know, it's ambiguous at this point. There are volcanic structures on Titan that may be, there's indirect evidence they may be spewing ice and ammonia. Not lava volcanoes, nothing like that.
Right.
All right, so we can just go back and say that we were all correct.
If you wish.
Yes,
if that makes you feel better. So the story was just more complicated. I just had found some additional information.
Enfeebled. Very good.
Looks like they need new ways to classify, you know, volcanic phenomena.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
is it
lava is one kind, ice is another.
Ammonia, you know, nitrogen,
right.
Sulfur, all kinds of things. And
we
what's when's a geyser a volcano?
Right.
We need some volcanologists. Maybe we can call one on the show and
clarify for us. I wonder if you need the strong tidal forces to create, you know, a nitrogen volcano or nitrogen geyser. Do you need tidal stresses to do that, or can some other mechanism produce that?
That was the only one that I heard. I mean, so you either have heat left over from your formation, some internal heat, or there's got to be something that's producing heat. And other than tidal forces, I'm not sure what else would do that.
Oh, don't forget radioactive decay. I mean, that's
the main reason,
you know,
we haven't cooled off yet.
Right.
It's time to play Science or Fiction.
So this week's Science or Fiction is going to be a little different than previous ones. It's still three items. One item is the correct answer, but it's more of a multiple choice question than two being legitimate, one being fiction. What I'm going to give you is three classic pseudosciences. The question is a historical question about these pseudosciences. Which one had proponents that were actually on the correct side of a major scientific debate? So my theme for this week is right for the wrong reason. Which pseudoscientists, if you will, historically were on the correct side of a major scientific debate, even though, of course, their underlying belief system is still false and pseudoscientific. You ready? Do you understand the question?
So some guy believes that the Earth is round because a big monkey bent it around.
Right. Correct.
Okay.
Right.
Got it.
Well, I assume it's not going to be obvious, you know, if you tell us something that he believed that we know is true.
I'm not telling you what the belief was, because that would be too obvious. I'm just telling you, I'm just going to give you one word. I'm going to give you three pseudosciences. You tell me, historically, which one of those three was actually on the correct side of a major scientific debate, and then I'll tell you at the end what the major scientific debate was.
Okay,
ready?
Ready.
The first one is astrology. The second one is phrenology. And the third one is homeopathy. All three pseudosciences with which we are very familiar.
Right, but these are definite pseudosciences. But you're saying someone in the past supported one of these phenomena?
Some major proponents of either astrology, phrenology, or homeopathy were actually on the correct side of a scientific debate. They were proven correct over time on one point that was integral to their belief system.
Okay.
But it didn't validate any of the pseudosciences in the process, right?
No, everything else was still turned out to be wrong. It didn't validate the bottom line pseudoscience.
Right. Just some subtle point.
It wasn't so subtle. It was a major component of their belief system.
Boy, I'm tending towards the astrology one.
I say phrenology.
Okay.
Bumps on the head. Yeah.
Go ahead, Bob. Take homeopathy.
Phrenology.
No, I'm taking phrenology as well.
Yeah.
I
two phrenology and Evan for astrology. Evan, what do you think? What's your thinking, Evan?
No, because, you know, it's effectively, I believe, where the roots of astronomy did derive from, if I'm not mistaken, was something closer to astrology as we recognize it today.
Mm-hmm.
It just has a deeper history than I think either phrenology or homeopathy have, which are, by comparison, much more recent phenomenon. So perhaps there was a lot more time there for the astrologers to have stumbled across something correct in regards to astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I'm going to guess that.
Perry, what you're thinking with phrenology?
Oh, just that since it involves the head and bumps on the head, it's probably not too far of a leap to think that they came up with something regarding brain, the nervous system, something mm-hmm. medical that was reasonable in a dark age. That's what I believe.
Bob, similar? Do you have anything more specific?
Yeah, this week's is a little different in that you can't use general critical thinking and scientific knowledge to kind of divine an answer. It looks like you're asking for a specific knowledge of something that you really need to make an answer more so than usual. But for, I'm going with
this is more of a fundamental knowledge question than a logic question.
Right. Well, I'm going with phrenology because I know that phrenology, when it was first developed, when it was first being looked into and believed, there was a happy side effect. Because people were so into phrenology and examining bumps in the head, it actually created a much more interest in the brain and the structure of the brain and different parts of neuroscience than was warranted at the time. So they actually had a nice increase in scientific knowledge that they wouldn't necessarily have had until maybe many decades later, all caused by phrenology, mm-hmm. which of course is ridiculous.
Right, then different bumps meant different things, like different parts of the brain affect different things, mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Right.
And that sort of
connection. Well, phrenology is the correct answer. And Perry, you're very basically on target with your analysis. The major scientific debate was whether or not the different functions of the brain were diffuse or compartmentalized. In other words, does everything that the brain does, memory, motor function, vision, calculation, remembering music, identifying objects, are those functions distributed throughout the brain sort of evenly, or is there one piece of the brain that has a specific function? Is this piece of the brain the motor function, this piece of the brain vision? The phrenologists supported the side of that debate that said that the brain was compartmentalized and specialized. However, there was a major part of the medical, scientific, neurological community that said that neurological brain function was diffuse. It turns out that the phrenologists were right. They were on the correct side of that debate. Of course, all of the other components of their claim that if you use a certain part of the brain, like if you use the music part of your brain, that part of the brain would grow bigger and would push the skull out, therefore creating a bump over the music part of your brain. That part is all incorrect. The brain does not actually change its size based upon usage, and like a muscle does. That was their analogy. It was sort of a false analogy to a muscle. Neither does the skull move out of the way of the brain. The brain's like Jell-O. Skull pushes the brain into its shape. The brain does not push the skull into the brain shape.
Doesn't it get more crinkly, though, Steve?
No, I mean, the brain's as crinkly as it is. That's
skull.
A matter of...
Not because of the skull.
No, that's not really true. I mean, the brain just develops that way. All the folds, the gyri and sulci in the brain are formed that way because it's genetically programmed to form that way.
Well, look at the strapping that certain cultures do of the head. Because the skull is so malleable at an early age, you could shape your head into pretty much anything you want it to look like. And, of course, the brain just blithely takes it in stride with no apparent deficits.
The brain happily conforms to whatever shape your skull is in.
Right, whatever the container is, it's just the brain just kind of, changes shape.
Steve, I
thought I was, somewhat on track with the fact that, phrenology caused
I'm not
more.
Sure if that's even true, Bob. I've never read that in all of my reading about the history of neurology or phrenology.
Do you want me to get a source?
Yeah, sure.
For you?
I mean, it may be true. I've never encountered that claim, so I don't know if it's true or not. There was quite an interest in neurology without phrenology. And that debate was raging without the phrenologists as well, though the phrenologists were major players in that debate, you know, 250, 300 years ago.
Well, my astrologer is advising me to not engage into this debate, so I'll remain silent.
Evan, your reasoning was sound. I mean, astrology certainly is much, much older than either phrenology, which is about, or homeopathy, both of which are, you know, 200 to 300 years old. But ancient astrologers, they had a very, pre-scientific view of the universe, of the stars and the planets, and they were not on the correct side of.
Well, it seemed likely that they made a guess about something that was going on in the cosmos that they happened to stumble upon. Just seemed like a reasonable.
It was a reasonable
guess.
Logic, but just, I think historically just not correct.
Homeopathy was easy to get rid of because anyone who believes in homeopathy couldn't possibly be correct about
it. Right, there's nothing. There's no component of their, you know, homeopathy is using substances diluted to the point of literally non-existence. And the
law of infinitesimals is so juvenile.
It's pretty scientific.
As to
it really
not,
is.
Not to be believed.
Right. Surprisingly, though, there was a happy side effect with homeopathy way back, in that you were much better off, you know, drinking pure water than bloodletting.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Or some other medicine they tried to shove into you at the time, which would definitely
at the time they were experimenting with a lot of toxic minerals as for drugs. And they were all, you know, more harmful than good. So yeah, going from the medicine of the time to nothing, to basically water, was actually an advantage.
I understand leeches are making a comeback.
Leeches.
They are. Yeah.
Where?
No, I understand. That's true.
Where?
They are. They really are.
For sure.
In Yale, Steve? Are they using them in Yale? Are they using
not
them
that
in
I've ever encountered.
Don't they feed on, like, necrotic tissue and things
yeah.
like that? Bacteria?
Really that's
well, those are maggots, Bob. And they're, you know, sometimes they will, I've never seen this done, but allegedly you can use maggots to essentially eat up all the dead tissue out of a wound.
Right.
To debride
right.
a
but
wound.
But in a pinch, right. We're saying to use these alternatives in lieu of another option that doesn't exist at the time or place, right? I mean, aren't there better ways to deal with these things that leeches and maggots do in a modern scientific medical
Depends
setting?
Depends on what you mean by better.
Well, that's for I guess that's for.
No,
the
apparently, I mean, I wouldn't want to have maggots crawling inside my wound, so I'd be happy with just a surgeon with a scalpel debriding it if there were dead tissue there. But,
right.
But
well,
the maggots do a fine job
point.
Of eating up all the dead skin. They eat it, and they don't eat any of the live skin, so it works.
What's the negative part of the maggot chewing on
you
your...
Maggot.
Maggots crawling on you.
Okay. That's the idea.
It's what they...
You're saying it's not a chick maggot. You're saying it doesn't attract
the
chicks.
They turn into flies.
I saw a show that had a little 5-minute blurb on that, you know, many moons ago, and... My memory is telling me that there was some application that was, you know, it was very efficient for that, you know, there was really almost, I don't want to say no alternative, but it works so well for certain applications.
The maggots, you mean?
Yeah, the maggots. That the guy with the doctor was saying that, I mean, this is such an excellent treatment for this, that it's much, much easier and much more specific than even he could be with his scalpel or something like that.
Does that have to be prescribed?
Get a prescription? I don't think it's not a FDA-controlled drug, so no.
Interesting.
It's a procedure, I guess.
What does the FDA have to say about
those
know. Kinds of things?
I don't know. Nothing that I know of.
Interesting.
Well, let's bring on our guest at this time. So with us this week is Steve Malloy. Steve is the publisher of JunkScience.com, a website dedicated to exposing bad science of all stripes. He's also an adjunct scholar of the Cato Institute and author of Junk Science Judo, Self-Defense Against Health Scares and Scams, as well as several other books on junk science. Steve, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We've talked about your website previously on our show. We go there frequently to look at the items. How long have you been doing this?
We started JunkScience.com on April 1st, 1996. So we're actually in our 10th year.
Great,
now.
Great. And what got you interested in this topic?
I used to work... for a guy who was a consultant to businesses on regulatory issues. And I started out working on health risk issues, and I have kind of a – I had a unique background for my boss. I have a background in public health as well as a law degree. So I was working with regulatory agencies, and I was working on a number of different health risk issues, and it struck me that no matter what statistical analysis or scientific fact I took to the agency, they had often already made up their minds. And they just weren't open to better science or better analysis or facts or anything like that. And so then I went and started my own business. I got a contract from the Department of Energy to do a study for them on the role of science in environmental policy. And it started to slowly dawn on me that most policy, especially in the environmental area, is not really based on science. It's just based on politics. And, from there, one thing led to another. I did my a little book called Science Without Sense, The Risky Business of Public Health Research, which is a short sort of tongue-in-cheek manual on how to do a health scare. And the publication of that was received pretty well in the public health community, and that sort of coincided with the rise of the Internet. So junkscience.com was born.
It was a natural extension of what you were doing.
Yeah.
Similar with us, I think, we got into skepticism and pretty much, in the mid-90s, as the Internet was becoming what it is, and it was natural for us to move more and more of our activities onto the Internet. It's a great way to reach people.
I mean, 10 years ago, someone like me had great difficulty trying to get a message app, but with the Internet, I don't need a printing press. All I need is a computer, and all this stuff is.
And people will find you. What I find is people who are interested in the topic that you're writing about will find you because they'll search for it. So you don't have to go out and get your message out. You just have to have it there. People will find it when they're interested in it.
Right. In the old days, I would have to try to have maybe an op-ed or an opinion piece published in a newspaper. Which, now is no problem, but 10 years ago when I was kind of unknown and had no track record or, reasons for anyone to publish anything I wrote, it was difficult. So the Internet, sort of helped me get where I am today.
So you were also, and it says an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. Now, the Cato Institute is a libertarian advocacy group. So it's hard not to notice the intimate relationship between the junkscience.com and the Cato Institute. In fact, I've read your articles on both websites, often on the same topics. So how much of this is intertwined, your defense of good science, or I guess your attack of junk science or bad science, particularly how it relates to public policy? How much of that is tied to your political views?
Well, I tell you, when I first got into this business, I was completely apolitical. Wasn't a Democrat, wasn't a Republican, didn't even know how to spell libertarian. And I really started going at this from just looking at the science. But of course, once you get into junk science, it's more than you start out with the science, but then you have to look at, okay, this is bad science. It's obviously bad science. Why would anyone, advocate this or try to promote an agenda with this? And so you have to look at what's behind the bad science. And, more often than not, I find that the bad science is, a government agency, some sort of social activist, a trial lawyer, something of that ilk. I don't often find libertarians trying to impose, use bad science to impose their views on people. It's not to say that, on the right side of the political spectrum, there aren't people that try to use bad science. There certainly are. In my view, I don't see good science as being inconsistent with individual liberty and limited government.
Your views remind me a lot of John Stossel.
Stossel, Stossel's a good friend of mine, and he'll tell you that.
Right.
He started out as a consumer reporter, always sort of bashing industry, thinking that the Ralph Nader viewpoint was correct, and you know, as he became more sophisticated and learned a few things, he flip-flopped. And, you know, now he's one of me.
Right. He realized that the government, despite the best intentions, just by its, the nature of the beast, usually makes things worse than better.
Well, you know, people that, have an agenda, activists, a lot of times they'll just say and do anything to have their agenda implemented. And, you know, if it involves science, well, then there you go. That's where junk science comes from.
Right. Now, of course, just as, you know, we're skeptics, we're skeptical activists, if you will, we defend quality science, you know, logic and reason from people who have an agenda, whether it's political or social or religious. So I definitely see this as part of the same, you know, skeptical philosophy that we endorse. But there are some issues where I think that are still pretty thorny. There are not that many issues about which educated, I think, bright skeptics and scientists will disagree. I think the one that comes up a lot, especially recently, and is featured on your website, is global warming.
Mm-hmm.
This is a subject about which, you know, I think informed, well-meaning people can disagree. You have on your website the Kyoto count-up, where you're counting up how much money, it's now up to $83 billion, is costing. I assume that's the world. That's
yes,
just the worldwide cost.
Globally.
And its potential savings. Now, reading your various articles on global warming, it certainly seems like you're attacking a lot of the environmentalism that is based upon claims of global warming, and maybe I just haven't dug down deep enough yet. I haven't really heard you attack the concept of global warming itself, so I'm just wondering where you stand on just the science of global warming.
Well, I think I've written about global warming so many times that, and I'm sure my editors at FoxNews.com get tired of me writing about global warming, so I don't always go over all the science all the time.
Right.
But we can certainly talk about it if you want.
What's the bottom line? What do you think?
I don't think that there's anything close to being credible science showing that humans are adversely impacting global climate. I mean, can humans affect local climate? Sure. All you got to do is look at, you know, if you live in an urban area, your evening weather map, and you'll see that the urban area is warmer than the area surrounding that, and that's because of the urban heat island effect.
Right.
Does that local change, can that become global climate change? Well, I don't really think that there's any evidence of that. I mean, you know, more than 99% of greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere are natural, not man-made. There's lots
like
of
bovine flatulence.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
Climate is extremely complex. We still can't even model clouds. The notion that we're going to, you know, that somehow by reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we can adjust, you know, our thermostat like you can in your house is crazy. And then when you look at the potential costs of doing this, you know, we live in a very, you know, an energy-hungry society, and our economy depends on energy. And the notion that we're going to somehow interfere with that process in some, you know, more than likely vain hope of controlling climate just seems ludicrous to me.
Well, the standard response is that...
Oh, don't be shy. Just
well, this is an issue, about which I am on the fence, although I will say that I think that there is sufficient evidence, I think, for concern. The difficulty is knowing exactly what policies to make because the implications are huge. I mean, the implications to our economy,
right,
to the world economy,
right,
to any, you know, control over the flow of energy is just enormous. And unless we proceed from the best science possible, we're likely to, again, cause more harm than good. But I do think that there is a scientific consensus that global warming is a real man-made effect.
I would take issue with just that very point.
Which is that there's a consensus.
That very point, right. I would challenge the nature of the consensus. And
do you agree that with their conclusion, or are you saying that there is no consensus, that there's disagreement?
I think there is disagreement, and then I realize that there are a lot of climatologists, a lot of scientists who are even tangentially involved in global warming who say that it's happening. But I think you have to look at the federal government spends about $2 billion a year on climate research, and all that money goes to scientists who say that, yes, climate change is happening. Because once they stop saying that climate change is not happening, they're not going to be getting the $2 billion anymore. So there's a sort of institutional bias in promoting the hysteria.
Are there any independent ones that are more reliable, say, or non-politically based?
I don't really put too much stock in the independence of scientists necessarily. I'd rather look at their scientific data first. But there is this situation where skeptical climatologists they are not funded to do research. There's no research money going to them, so you don't hear from them as much. They can't afford the media releases. They can't afford, they're not supported by environmental groups. They don't have the power of federal agencies, so you don't get to hear from them as much. It's a real, there's a little cadre of people that I work with on this issue, and it's been quite a struggle to get the skeptical voice on climate change heard, because we're just so underfunded.
Well, one of the arguments that's put forward is that we man-made activity is increasing the amount of CO2 that is being dumped into the atmosphere, and we have a pretty good idea about how much CO2 is going into the atmosphere. Saying that a lot of it is natural is misleading if you're counting cow flatulence, because having vast herds of domestic animals is actually a man-made situation. So that I don't think you could dismiss that as quote unquote natural. But also we know, the greenhouse effect is a well understood phenomenon. There's not a lot of mystery as to what's going on there. So it stands to reason that if we know the greenhouse effect, we know how it works, we're increasing the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, why wouldn't that increase temperature over time?
Whether or not you consider, cow flatulence man-made or not, I still maintain that well over 99% of greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere are natural. If you look at, let's just take the 20th century, for example, half the warming in the 20th century occurred before 1940, but the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions occurred after 1940. And if you look at the period 1940 to 1970, when greenhouse gas emissions were really taking off, there was actually global cooling, which in 1975, the alarmists like Stephen Schneider were worried about, a looming ice age. If you look at, 1,000 years ago, the Vikings were cultivating Greenland. Since, starting in the 14th century with the advent of the Little Ice Age, it became a frozen wasteland. And Little Ice Age lasted until about the 19th century, which happens to coincide with the Industrial Revolution. It's quite possible that, the warming we've witnessed over the last 200 years is simply just, our rebound from the Little Ice Age.
Of course, that is the standard sort of anti-global warming argument, that the warming that we are recording is just a natural fluctuation in worldwide temperatures,
and
we know that this occurs. No, I agree. That is the argument to make, and it's legitimate because we don't know. That the bottom line is we don't know if the warming that we're recording is man-made or if it is what would have happened anyway. I think the big problem is that because we're trying to predict long-term, global climate effects, there's going to be huge room for skepticism in the kind of data that we can get until it's largely occurred. And one argument is that, well, by the time we know for sure, and we've basically convinced all the skeptics that global warming is real, it's too late to do anything about it. So, you know, we do have to accept a certain amount of uncertainty and make the best judgment we can based upon the data that we do have. And perhaps that could be used to justify some reasonable environmental measures to limit greenhouse gases.
I mean, I guess I would say in response to that, you know, forgetting about arguing about the science anymore, you know, even if the Kyoto Protocol were fully implemented, I think by 2050, it would reduce or avoid a potential 0.07 of a degree of warming at just an astronomical cost. And
how is that determined?
You know,
by the amount of CO2 that the protocols would prevent.
And they could tie that directly to a drop in temperature or a change in temperature?
Yeah, I think the general circulation models they have can tell you, you know, based on how much carbon dioxide is emitted, and, you know, they'll give you an answer. Now, you got to keep in mind that those models have never been validated against historical temperatures, so for whatever, who knows what they're worth.
Hmm.
And I also, you know, there's also this assumption, and I think that, you know, this is very important. You know, we talked earlier about how climate changes naturally. You know, whether we're releasing CO2 or not, climate is going to change. The question is it going to get warmer, is it going to get cooler? You know, if it gets cooler, you know, that could be a bad thing for agriculture, and we depend on agriculture. If it gets warmer, it's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, just because it gets warmer, there may be benefits. So we don't know what climate change holds for us. I mean, obviously an extreme change would not be good, but even a mild cooler change would not be good. We're not going to be able to keep the temperature the same. I mean, that's just impossible. Who's to say that a slight increase is going to be bad?
Yeah, we obviously don't know. I mean, there are concerns about, for example, decreasing the salinity in the North Atlantic and shutting down the oceanic currents, even with a slight increase in temperature. But again, these are theoretical.
Well, what about
obviously
hurricanes? What about hurricane strengths? A lot more F5s potentially with a warmer Earth.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because the guy who I think first advanced the idea that global warming was going to intensify hurricanes, Kerry Emanuel from MIT, he's got this great posting on his website. You know, there's been a lot of attempts to link Katrina with global warming. I mean, he says that is absurd. I mean, using that word, you know, he says that, you know, even if there is more intense hurricanes, it's not clear that, you know, these hurricanes are really making landfall in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, okay, let's say we have more intense hurricanes in the Atlantic. You know, if a tree falls in the woods and no one hears it, you know, who cares?
So let's change gears a little bit. I also noticed on your website one thing that caught my attention was an article you had written about the government's attack on the Atkins diet. Basically, I guess it was a University of Arkansas researchers claiming that high carbohydrate, low fat diets actually promote weight loss above and beyond a reduction in calories. And you know, you did what any good science journalist should do. You actually read the original study, which showed that they were decreasing the people who had the high carbohydrate diet.
They were losing weight, were actually eating
right,
less.
They were consuming 400, 600 fewer calories a day, or they were working out, or, you know, and or they were exercising.
Right, or something.
Which is, you know, exactly, I've actually written quite a bit about this topic myself, although I've looked at the pro-Atkins research and found the same thing, that the studies would show weight loss actually, it all correlates with fewer caloric intake. So, I couldn't find any of your writings except criticizing the anti-Atkins, you know, people who you said were defending the government, the nanny government, basically. But so, what is? I guess my question is, what's your take on the Atkins diet itself?
Well, I don't really know. Would never profess to say that one diet is superior to another. I think that for individuals and their lifestyles, everyone is going to have, you know, something different. What I objected to about that study is that, you know, I think that, you know, the federal government has a lot invested in certain myths. And the myths are that, you know, saturated fat is bad for you, salt is bad for you, cholesterol, all these things are bad for you. And anything that runs into, you know, their dogma is bad. And Atkins did that in spades because Atkins, you know, said you could eat, you know, larger amounts of fat and cholesterol and, you know, as long as you limited your carbs, you'd be okay. So that, you know, was a politically incorrect diet. And I think they went after it for political reasons. And, you know, I objected to that. I'm not defending the Atkins diet because I think it works. I mean, who knows? I mean, whether you lose weight or not depends on how much you eat, how active you are, your genetics, lots of reasons, not necessarily specific diet.
Right. Well, I think I agree with your assessment of diet. I mean, my bottom line point from reading all of the studies is that, just, you know, from what we know about basic physiology, is the only thing that really matters is calories in, calories out. And in terms of weight loss, just specifically weight loss, it doesn't matter what form those calories take. So I would say the exact same criticism applies to the pro-Atkins diet, you know, research as well. But you know, you kind of lose me a little bit when you sort of premise your opinion on the fact that the government is defending their dogma. And I'm not really sure that that's what it's all about, because independent of the food pyramid and the government programs, there is a academic nutrition scientist who have been, you know, happily doing research over the last 30 and 40 years, who, you know, I think objected to the claims of the extreme low carbohydrate diet claims based upon the science, not on some government agenda. The fact is that the claims they were making did not size up well with the evidence, did not correlate with what we know about human physiology, and they also exceeded the evidence. And it's true we don't know the implications of a lot of this. And there were a lot of interesting studies done which were curious, like the fact that on a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet for 6 months or so, people's cholesterols actually went down. That was surprising. But it was also certainly was not covered up or denied by the government. It was just, that doesn't mean that a lifetime of a high-fat diet's a good thing for you.
I'm not defending the Atkins diet. I have no... no dog in that race. But you know, I do know, and I do have experience with government agencies who will hold on to a position, however ridiculous it is. You know, a good one on a dietary, good example of this on a dietary issue, is the NIDDK, National Institute for Digestive and Kidney Disease, and their recommendations on salt. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're you know, there is absolutely not a single scientific study that shows that, you know, reducing salt consumption in healthy people reduces blood pressure and improves their health. There's not a single study.
I totally agree with you there.
Yet they maintain, and you know, last year they came out with a recommendation that, you know, Americans should cut their dietary salt in half. It's just crazy.
What's the motivation? Why? Why would they do that?
I can say is that they have maintained, you know, in the 70s, when all this sort of, you know, health and dietary science became very much in vogue, you know, they just latched onto it, and they think that if they have to go back and say, well, salt is really okay, then they think they lose some credibility. And I think there's a lot of examples.
As well they should.
You know, dietary fiber is a great example.
No, I disagree with you, Perry. I think that if they change their position, that would actually gain them credibility. You lose credibility when you maintain a wrong position in spite of evolving scientific evidence.
I agree with that, but I meant that if they change their position after the lack of evidence has been around for so long, I think that that's demonstrative of their actual position.
I would argue that they lose more credibility, though, by resisting the evidence.
But that's probably true.
Yeah, somehow they're able to keep resisting. I mean, Gary Taubes wrote a great article in Science Magazine a few years ago about NIH and salt. And they unabashedly, they're lowering their salt recommendations even more. So,
interesting. I can't believe there's
bureaucratic stubbornness.
Is there an anti-salt lobby out there that we're not aware of?
You know, there's, I mean, there's lots of these crazy notions out there. Dietary fiber, you know, that was very popular. Dietary fiber reduces the risk of colon cancer. And do you know where that came from? Some British missionary in the late 1960s, early 1970s sort of casually observed that people in Africa had reduced rates of colon cancer, and he kind of casually related it to high-fiber diets, and that became all the rage.
Right.
That's the extent of the evidence?
But there's not a single study that's ever shown that high-fiber diets reduce
colon cancer. There were some recent studies which actually show a lack of a benefit from high-fiber diets.
Wow.
So, I mean, I agree with you. I think that the phenomenon that are at work here, one is the media will latch on to very preliminary findings and make a very bottom line recommendation, like Oprah prevents heart attacks, when in fact the evidence is very preliminary. And then, you know, 5-10 years later, the research sorts itself out, and maybe the effect is either real or it's not real. And if it's not, you know, you don't really hear much about it. It just becomes sort of fixed in the minds of the public. I also think there's a lot of bureaucratic inertia at work. I'm not sure that I agree with the assessment that there's a resistance to or a dogmatic resistance to adjusting the recommendations based upon the scientific evidence, especially within the scientific institutions. I mean, obviously that occurs to some degree, but that usually works itself out. For example, with the food pyramid, the old food pyramid, you know, the one that was out through the 90s, was old only, I think, really just because of bureaucratic sort of inertia and laziness. It was just outdated, and they didn't bother to update it. Yeah. And a lot of their bottom-line recommendations were wrong because the science was just a little bit outdated. But they've revised their food pyramid based upon, I think, a pretty reasonable assessment of our current evidence, and which is in line with what independent academicians are saying. So I do think there's the potential to, you know, for the government to revise their recommendations based upon new evidence. I think the sense that I get, and this is, I guess, sort of a soft criticism, I agree with, you know, I've read a lot of what you wrote on the websites, and obviously you're, you know, I agree with most of the stances that you take, although it seemed to me that you almost started from the position that the government was wrong because it's the government. And, you know, sometimes, don't you, is there, maybe I'm a
dissenter. Is that my libertarian bias?
I had to think to myself.
Maybe. I'll tell you what, give me an example where the government's right.
The latest food pyramid got it right. I mean, I think they fixed it based upon the evidence. Now, 5 years from now, it'll probably be wrong again.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, I don't even really know what that means. I mean, it's not like there's a right answer for any one person. You know, people can survive on a variety of diets, and it really depends on a number of factors, your lifestyle, your genetics. A food pyramid, I'm not even quite sure what the value of that is.
I think it's basic bottom-line recommendations about what a healthy diet would be like. Not to give very specific recommendations, but just to say, you know, you're probably better off if you eat more fruits and vegetables.
But, you know, it's kind of like it's designed for this, you know, theoretical average person, which doesn't exist. You know, all the nutrition labels that we see and all, like, you know, the RDAs and, you know, recommended calories of 2,000 calories per day, you know, that's all designed for menopausal women. It's got nothing to do with, I mean, 2,000 calories a day for me, I would be dead. I mean, I'm 6 foot, about 200 pounds.
You're definitely right.
I mean, 2,000 calories goes quick, that's for sure.
The labels are ridiculous.
I do not think that the fact that, you know, the types of foods that are more healthy or less healthy has to do too much with the individual. The amount of calories that you eat, absolutely, that's based upon your metabolism, your size, your body weight, whether you're male or female, absolutely. Just having 2,000 calories per day for
muscle,
everyone, obviously,
not
is ludicrous. But I don't know. I don't think that saying that, you know, people's genetics and other metabolic factors differ invalidates the basic concepts that, you know, you need to have a varied diet that has a, you know, minimal amounts of vitamins and minerals, and you're probably better off eating, you know, a food that was not too calorie dense, and you're probably better off not eating, you know, a diet that was filled too much. Now, you see, previously you said that the saturated fat thing was a myth. I'm not sure that I agree with that specific claim either.
Well, I mean, you can, you know, if you look at the Harvard Nurses Study, for example, you know, a study of 90,000 women for 25 years, you'll find that there is no association between saturated fat intake and heart disease. And I doubt that it's just a figment of that study. And the reason I got into this because I started looking at the whole trans fat thing. You remember, you know, saturated fat was bad, no
right.
butter. And in the 70s and 80s, we switched
even
to margarine,
worse,
and now margarine's trans fats, so they're horrible. So we got to go to something else. And I looked into that, and I learned that it's basically this guy at Harvard University, Walter Willett, who, you know, he's behind virtually every trans fat study, and he has succeeded in railroading trans fats, even though there's not a single study of humans that shows trans fat is associated with heart disease risk. When the National Research Council came out with their report a couple years ago, they didn't cite any epidemiologic studies
right.
about trans fats. They just cited animal studies that reported increases
right.
in LDL. You know, to me, that is just not a
reason. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of weaknesses in that research. I mean, you can't do the kind of, you know, class one studies that you would like to do where you force feed people trans fat and other people, you know, so-called good fat, and then see who does better over time. You just can't do those studies for ethical reasons. So we're left with sort of the secondary evidence, which is inferential, epidemiological or animal data. There's always going to be room for skepticism with that kind of evidence.
Yeah, I mean, these are all fine debates to have. I don't begrudge Walter Willett or anybody else from raising these issues and debating them. Where I begrudge them and where we go into the junk science is when, you know, they come up with these, you know, at best preliminary studies and then
right.
immediately jump to the policy conclusion. We must do...
Becomes gospel.
It becomes gospel, right. And, I really have a problem with that.
I agree with you there. I mean, I do think that the majority of government policy is based
definitely.
Upon either too preliminary evidence or, you know, hysterically hyped evidence or claims.
You know, and worse, you know, you can't even really check. I hate to keep picking on Willett, but you really can't even check his work because he maintains some sort of, you know, even though his data is financed by taxpayers. He maintains some proprietary control over it so that, you know, no one can get it and do independent research to verify his results.
Right.
And, you know, that's just not the scientific method.
Are you familiar with Dr. Elizabeth Whelan?
Yes, I am. I know her very well.
Yeah, I imagine you would. So she is the president of the American Council on Science and Health, of which I am a member, by the way. And she again has a very, very similar approach. The American Council on Science and Health is dedicated to exposing basically bad science in public health policy.
Right.
I just received one of their latest pamphlets called Good Stories, Bad Science, A Guide for Journalists to the Health Claims of Consumer Activist Groups. Again, very reminiscent of what you're doing. So I just was curious, you know, do you have any direct involvement with the Council on Science and Health, or you just know her because of
I've done
overlapping agenda?
I've done things with them in the past. I know Beth very well. I know many of her members and board members very well, and I support what she does. And I would say 99% of the time we agree on things.
If there weren't 1% of the time, you'd have to wonder, right?
plus or minus 1%.
I mean,
we've had some disagreements on some tobacco issues, but
right. You bring that up. So Elizabeth Whelan has been very vocal. I mean, although she sort of takes two positions with tobacco, the two sort of bottom line positions are yes, it causes cancer and is a bad thing, but the secondhand smoke evidence is total bunk. I'm not sure if you agree with that with my assessment. That's her sort of bottom line take on the tobacco evidence. But you said you disagree with her on what point specifically?
Well, I agree with you that, you know, her position on I think where we've always had our difference was on secondhand smoke, and I think that if she is now saying that secondhand smoke doesn't appear to be the risk that, you know, the EPA and the anti-tobacco groups are saying that it is, that's somewhat of a switch from her older position.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think secondhand smoke is a health risk. Direct smoking certainly is a health risk, especially
right.
if you smoke too much.
Right.
She did not always hold up.
We are moving closer to that 100%.
Okay. So you thought that she endorsed the claim that secondhand smoke causes is a significant risk factor for lung cancer, which you took exception to. Well, at least the most recent interview I saw with her, which in fact was on Penn and Teller's show Bullshit, where they covered this topic and they interviewed her for it, and she was endorsing their position, which was that the evidence basically does not support that conclusion.
Then we have no issues.
So we're down to, that was the 1%, huh? So, which is interesting because I'm a physician and an academic, so this is an old issue for scientists, sort of confusing absolute risk and relative risk, which is basically what they did with the secondhand smoke data. They sort of gave figures which were basically comparing relative risk between people who were exposed to secondhand smoke and who weren't, and the numbers can sound huge. For example, like you said, there's a threefold, relative risk of lung cancer, but if it goes from 1 to 3 out of a million people, it's really only 2 people out of a million, which is the absolute risk. So it turns out if you really look at the studies that were done, the absolute risk was very, very low. I mean, there's a very few extra cases of lung cancer.
If there was a risk at all.
Right. Well, you could challenge sort of the statistical significance of the studies, but even if you just take their own data at face value, it doesn't really support a huge risk.
Absolutely.
But the press latched onto the relative risk, which was, I believe, something like a 60 or 70% increase, which sounds huge.
Right.
I think the press latched onto, this is the way that we're going to beat up the tobacco industry, which we hate, and they did.
Right.
To great effect.
Right. Absolutely, it certainly was the tipping point. That data that now not only are you not harming yourself, you're harming other innocent people, innocent bystanders. That from my recollection was the tipping point of public opinion and policy opinion against smokers in general and the tobacco industry, et cetera.
Right.
And
it was a strategy that the anti-tobacco industry started working on in the 70s
and it
paid off in 1993.
Yeah,
93, right?
Now you can't smoke in a bar in New York City anymore.
Or a lot of places.
I'm not a smoker myself, and I can't tell you how many girlfriends when I was younger who smoked. I stopped going out with,
mm-hmm.
and I find it odd having to defend mm-hmm. The tobacco industry on this issue. But
I feel exactly the same way.
Exactly.
I feel exactly the same way. Smoking is repugnant, but so is this.
I don't like secondhand smoke, but hey, if it's not going to cause me cancer, then. That's the fact, and you gotta live up to the fact. Steve, I was just going through your website here, and back in late August, you had written an article for FoxNews.com called "Another Stem Cell Fast One." Maybe you can give us a little quick summary as to what your position on this is.
I guess my overall position is that. I'm skeptical of embryonic stem cell research. My skepticism stems from the notable lack of success the federal government has had in the war on cancer, where we've spent about upwards of $50 billion and have actually produced extremely little. And cancer, conceptually, should be an easier riddle than making embryonic stem cells work. And I just, I have little confidence, and I think private investors would back me up on this, that anyone will have any success with embryonic stem cells in any reasonable time frame to justify public expenditures.
You're saying it should be private, but private expenditures.
Illegal, but I think that a much better case needs to be made to get public funding for embryonic stem cell research.
Yeah, it's definitely embryonic stem cell research is one of those topics where it's any, I think, meaningful application of it is far enough in the future that nobody knows how it's going to pan out. It could be a total dead end. We have not established it yet to enough of a degree that we could meaningfully extrapolate you know, where the research is going to go. I think the thing that has
got
the people...
potential, though.
Yeah, that's exactly what has people starry-eyed. I was just about to say that the theoretical potential is so huge that that has generating all of the interest. But you're right. The fact is, it is kind of a scientific long shot. Although, you know, that brings up a very good question about how do we decide what to fund? Do we want to only fund research projects which are just, you know, taking one baby step beyond where we are right now, and we sort of have a very good idea of what we're going to get out of it? Or should we do some kind of pie-in-the-sky basic science research and just hope it leads to something?
You know, I mean, my basic view is that little good comes from federal government mucking around in scientific research.
Mm-hmm.
My position, if there's something worth pursuing that private investors, maybe this is the libertarian in me,
right?
Private investors will, you know, chase that down. You know, we've spent 30 years on cancer. Countless numbers of people have walked, run, rode countless miles. Billions and billions of dollars.
We're making steady progress with treating cancer. Cancer is not going to be anything that's going to be cured by a single treatment or a single advance. It's not even a single disease. It's a thousand different diseases.
Absolutely. But it's, I mean, what, you know, when are we going to have some? But people are looking for you know, tangible results. And
the tangible results are there, but they're just in a thousand baby steps. The survival curves for most cancers are improving every decade.
Well, yeah, but you know, a lot of that could be early detection.
Some of it.
Right.
But some of it's early detection, but some of it's improved chemotherapy and improved, you know, therapeutic modalities.
Yeah. I mean, I can go to the NIH website and look at their, you know, achievements over the last three decades, and they really only have two achievements for cancer. One is childhood leukemia, which they can do a pretty good job of now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And testicular cancer, which is what Lance Armstrong survived.
Right. Right.
After that, I mean, it's tough. They really don't know. And you know, we're getting so desperate now that, you know, we've got these drugs like Erbitux, mm-hmm. which seem to help 10% of the people in a study, and I'm not, you know, and it helped them live an extra 2 months, and I'm not quite sure that's really a result, and that,
right?
You know, there's just lots of questions that I have with that. So
no, it's definitely that, you know, cancer. I think if you asked anybody 50 years ago, they would have said, you know, that by the turn of the century, will we have cured cancer? Most people would have thought, sure, of course we will. I mean, it's 50 years from now. I can't imagine they wouldn't have cured it. But it's really proven to be a very, very, very tough nut
right.
to crack.
And you know,
so no
and the
question.
Government solution is just throw money at it.
Mm-hmm.
If we spend the money, we'll get the results. And that is that is just not true.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I do, you know, clinical research in ALS, which is another area where we have made negligible progress. And there are a lot of people, you know, definitely there's a lot of public interest in driving money for research, and they want money to find a cure, and they think that that's going to do it. And I agree that, you know, you can't predict if it's going to produce anything tangible or not. Of course, I'm a huge supporter of biomedical research. I think that even though the pace may be modest, we're still making a steady advance. The hype definitely does overplay the potential benefits of research, and that is definitely driven by the need to get research dollars. Hype brings in the dollars, and I've seen even very well-respected, you know, scientists sell their own research, you know, oversell it to the activist groups or the funding groups or whatever, because that's how you get the money. You know, you're not going to get money by saying, well, you know, after about 10 or 20 years, you know, we maybe will make some modest, you know, improvement, but, you know, we're nowhere near a cure, so just forget about that in your lifetime.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
may
that's,
be...
What's the alternative,
absolutely right.
Right?
That's the brutal truth, but no, you know, people who are beating the bushes for funding don't tell the brutal truth. They paint a rosy picture of what...
Right, so...
But what's the alternative?
What the embryonic stem cell researchers want to do is, you know, sell this hope to Congress so that Congress will open up the federal coffers and the money will just start flowing. And it's not going to be a lot of money. I mean, it's not the kind of money that's going to bankrupt the country. It's not like Medicare or Social Security or anything like that.
Boy.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just, you know, from this science perspective, you know, giving people false hope is worse than giving them no hope at all.
Well, I agree that the government should not be in the business of deciding what to fund. I think that, but I also don't think that it should just be totally left to private industry. I believe in the NIH and you know, government public funding for research projects. I think it should be, as you say, it shouldn't be outlawed or banned. I think federal, if you're going to fund biomedical research, fund whatever the scientists want to study. And you know, the sort of review process that exists now, it's imperfect. There's some political aspects to it, but
right.
the basic concept is a good one. You basically have research scientists review applications and decide, you know, hopefully on the merits of the application, which projects should get funded. I think that's the system that we should have. And if somebody wants to do stem cell research and they can make a good case for it, then you know, they could vie with all the other ideas that are out there for the funding.
I've been told that, you know, now there are some adult stem cell researchers who are having trouble getting support from, you know, like the, you know, various disease groups, you know, diabetes, what have you, while they'd be happy to get some progress with adult stem cell research, you know, they don't want to waste their political capital on that. They
right.
want to spend it on embryonic stem cell research, which is, you know, like it or not, a lot of people find it controversial.
Yeah.
You have the oddball like me. I have no confidence that it's ever going to produce anything. And
I think the science is sound. The potential there is actually quite enormous. The barriers are technological. And we just can't predict whether or not we'll be able to overcome them or not.
I hope they learn how to turn those little suckers off.
Big problem is that
you got cancers.
I know exactly. That is that is probably going to be one of the biggest hurdles is controlling
right.
The
stem cells. Right. And then you go back to the war on cancer, which they haven't solved. I mean, you know, it's really a daunting problem.
But it is interesting that, you know, fundraising for biomedical research can actually hurt research. Which sounds, you know, a little counterintuitive, but I'll give you my own personal experience with ALS research, is that in the last 10, 20 years, there have been a lot of patient groups and other, you know, grassroots sort of ALS research groups that have been raising a lot of money for clinical ALS research. But the problem is they've really been pushing for a cure. They want a study that could potentially find a cure. And because that's where they bring in money, researchers follow the money. You have no choice but to follow the money, because without money, you're not doing anything. So a lot of researchers and a lot of the research has shifted towards clinical ALS research, which I do. You know, I'm not bashing clinical ALS research. But I think the problem is that there's been now there's an imbalance between clinical research and basic science research. And I just don't think we understand enough about the disease to do a high probability clinical research. So I think we're wasting a lot of money doing low probability clinical research, and we're not doing enough basic science research. I think we really just have to go back to the drawing board. But there you have well-meaning, you know, groups raising money for biomedical research, and in fact they may be slowing down the progress in the field that they're interested in, ironically.
Yeah, I know. It's got to be the scientists that, you know, if we're going to have public dollars spent, it ought to be the scientists, you know, chasing
whatever they think is interesting.
Most likely prospects with the resources they have, rather than these pipe dreams driven by Christopher Reeve and Hollywood celebrities. It's just drives me crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the other thing is, if you just look historically at scientific progress, the things that people thought were going to be the sort of the big science advances of the future really never pan out. Like, you know, weren't we all supposed to be in flying cars by this year? The things that the real advances come out of the blue. Nobody anticipated them, but they sort of were byproducts of scientists doing, you know, research projects because they were interesting, not because they had any apparent application. Again, I just think we should need to let good scientists, you know, do what they want, follow what's interesting.
Yeah, and then you have, you know, also the scientific, the medical advances that are just accidental, like penicillin.
Sure. Right, exactly.
Yeah, there was no bench scientist sitting down figuring out how can we break down cell walls of bacteria.
Right. Well, it was a lucky observation that was capitalized by, you know, Fleming made the observation and capitalized on it, and coined the phrase, you know, fortune favors the prepared mind, and that's a lot of science as well. So I think we're almost out of time. So just
I got something quick, Steve.
Go ahead, Bob.
Steve, have you ever heard of, I'm sure you've probably heard of nanotechnology?
Yes.
So you probably heard it in reference to things like the gray goo problem and out of control.
To be honest with you, I don't really know that much about it.
Bob's a big nano proponent here, Steve. Be careful.
Well, the only thing I don't know anything about it other than environmentalists hate it.
Right.
One big, you know.
So therefore, I must be for it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the big issue is the big thing that's got people going crazy is the whole so-called gray goo problem, where you have these little nano replicators that all they do is replicate themselves until there's nothing left to change into themselves. So you turn the biosphere to dust in a week, and that's like the extreme situation.
That.
Yeah, let's not do that. But that's just. You know, the things that people
talk about.
Can't you
step on them and end it?
It's like stepping on dust. But it's the fears, those kind of fears weren't founded. I thought you might have heard of something like that.
So, Steve, just one final thought to close on. So, what are your plans for the future? Do you have any big dreams or goals in terms of junk science or any projects or publications?
Well, we're right now we're kind of overwhelmed with the whole global warming thing. It just seems to be the most.
Because of Katrina?
No, just
even prior
it's the hottest topic out there. It's swallowing up everything.
Yeah.
Junk science is kind of in a downswing. Right, the 90s was like the heyday of junk science. I mean, mm-hmm. you couldn't every week, between the New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of Medical Association, American Medical Association, and the Lancet, British Medical, there was always a new study coming out, with a health scare or a scam. So there was a lot to do. Since the Bush administration came into power, for some reason there's been a lot less of that, but global warming has just been a hot issue, and it's the only one people really care about. When I write a Fox column, the number of comments I get back from people is incredible. So we're kind of stuck on that for a while.
All right. Well, stay tuned. It would definitely something that we're following with interest. Again, I'm... still a little bit on the fence about it, though. I'm leaning towards the fact that there's at least enough there to be concerned about. And
executive director's with you, Steve Malloy. Keep up the good work.
Anytime you want.
We'll have to agree to disagree a little bit about
this. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for being on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
For our audience out there, thanks for joining us on the Skeptic's Guide. Till next week, this is your host, Stephen Novella.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information on this and other episodes, see our website at www.thenes.com.